Okay, so we've been looking at issues that concern the point-to-point transmission of information or frames over a single, excuse me, a single link. And so the main issues include how do you turn unreliable bit transmission into reliable data transmission? And then, if multiple entities are sharing this single link, how is that sharing accomplished? What we finally observed was that, we need to extend the range beyond sort of point-to-point connectivity, so sending from one user to the next over a single link. And with internetworking, we saw that there were a number of ways in which this could be accomplished, all of which required packet forwarding or data forwarding, but operating at different levels within our OSI stack. So we're now, again, in the context of the stack, going to look at end-to-end connectivity. And the issues around end-to-end connectivity within the stack are within the network are split up into two separate layers. The first is the network layer, and the network layer is going to be concerned with getting data, which we're going to call packets, from one physical machine to another physical machine. And then on top of that, we have the transport layer. And the idea here is that users are programs or processes, and any physical machine has a number of users, and the data, or a number of programs running, and the data is meant for one of these. So the transport layer is going to provide the end-to-end connectivity between the end programs. So not just the physical machines, but the processes running on those physical machines. And this provides the interface then between network services and the end user. Okay, so what does the network layer do? Well, again, it's responsible for getting packets from source to destination, where that's a physical source and destination, and it will do this potentially over multiple links within the network. Okay. The primary function is going to be routing, so deciding what path those packets will take through the network. In addition, it may perform some form of congestion control. Again, routing might the routing algorithms might try to sort of avoid congestion points or react to congestion points. We may have to negotiate with networks running, again, different protocols. And possibly we would think about the provision of quality of service. And again, as we noted in practice, that's sort of fairly far down the list of what happens. Okay, so we're going to concentrate on the issue of routing when we discuss the network layer. Okay, and other issues will arise, sort of possibly throughout the remaining lectures. Okay, so again, when we're thinking of the network layer, we're just going to think of how do we find a path for our packet to get from sender to receiver. The transport layer then is going to be responsible for end-to-end data transport. And so by end-to-end, we mean, again, process-to-process. Okay. And so it's providing the interface with the user, so it's going to be providing whatever networks it's going to ultimately provide that the network service and the two possibilities are going to be connection-oriented or connectionless, where, again, the connection-oriented service is error-free and the connectionless service makes no guarantees. Okay, so in order to do this, it's going to have some idea of what connections can be set up and released within between users. Okay. And so we're going to look at, in this lecture, we're going to look at specifically the idea of routing and what are the underlying principles behind routing. And then in the next lecture, we'll look at sort of how the network layer works in the context of the internet. As I mentioned before, the glue that holds the internet together is the IP protocol. And so we'll see how some of the details of that. And sitting on top of that, the transport layer protocols available in the TCP/IP stack, namely TCP and UDP, again providing the connection-oriented and connectionless services. Okay, and so we'll look at that in the next lecture as well. Okay, so to date, we've looked at the physical and data link layer, and we saw how the data link layer might need to be split up into, link layer and MAC sublayers. And now we're moving up the stack and considering the network layer as well. And so obviously the data link layer was a point-to-point connection. The network layer now has issues sort of globally, and it's going to have to account for the destination as well as the point-to-point connections. Okay, all of these, the three layers are again going to operate at each transient node or router in the middle of the path, and then the transport protocol acts end to end. Okay. So our routing algorithm again is trying to decide, given a destination, what path should we take? And these algorithms are going to be run at each node along the path. And so there's going to have to be some decision-making process at each node, knowing where, for each incoming packet, you need to know what outgoing link the packet should be transmitted on. Okay. Within packet switching, again, we've mentioned that we could either have datagram packet switching, and here the decision is made for every packet coming in, or virtual circuit packet switching, where we decide on a route once, and once that route is set up, all of the packets from source to destination will follow that same path. Okay. So desirable properties for our routing algorithms are obviously correctness, simplicity, and efficiency. You want them to work as well as possible. Robustness. We can't just be sort of resetting things all the time, or sort of, and you know, if a problem occurs in one component, we need to be able to work around that. Stability. And so the algorithm has to be able to react to changes relatively quickly, and then in the absence of changes, sort of not be arbitrarily changing what it does. And finally, from the performance point of view, two concepts that are important would be fairness and optimality. Okay, and the idea behind fairness is that our end users are sort of getting equal chance at the resources. And on the other hand, we also want the network to be using its resources as efficiently as possible. And often those two concepts or ideas are conflicting, as we'll see in the next example. Okay, so here, just to give an example, we have pairs of end users wishing to communicate. So A communicates with A prime, B communicates with B prime, C communicates with C prime, and X communicates with X prime. Okay. Now, if we solely allow connections between A, B, and A and A, A prime, B and B prime, C and C prime, and we allow them to fully monopolize those links, then to some extent that is an optimal solution. The network resources are being used as much as possible. Okay. So, from a network standpoint, the network might consider that to be a very good solution, an optimal solution. But if you happen to be user X, then it's a very unfortunate solution, because you are never going to you're never going to be able to access the network resources and send your data. So again, that's an example of where fairness and optimality are not working together. Okay, so one question to ask is, exactly what do we mean by optimality? What are we trying to optimize? And again, these quantities can be specified both in terms of the end users, and so what any individual end user is experiencing, or in terms of the network as a whole. Okay, so do we want to try and optimize average packet delay? Do we want a distribution on that packet delay? Are we concerned with total packet throughput, etc.? Okay. Also, so these sorts of goals often, again, conflict. Packet throughput, or highest packet throughput, can be achieved by operating our networks at near capacity. But the closer you or the closer you get to full capacity within a network, the longer the queues within the nodes of the network. And again, that translates into higher delay for individual packets. So you can have something, you know, lots of packets are being sent or passing through the network, but as far as the end user is concerned, there's an unacceptable performance issue for the packets being sent. Okay. So one heuristic and relatively easy compromise that we can make is to try and minimize the number of relays that a packet takes. So we're going to try and shorten the path of the packet as much as possible. Okay. So throughput will be achieved by, you know, being able to send more packets in, because each packet is going to be using less network resources. And again, by using the minimal amount of network resources possible, then we should be able to decrease the delay experienced in the network. Okay, so this leads to the idea of least cost routing. And so we can assign a value to every link in the network that we refer to as the cost of using this link. And the cost of using a route or a route is the combination of the values, the cost values of each of the individual links. So you just add them up. Okay. And we say that the best route through the network for a packet is the one with the lowest cost. Okay. And so if we can find this best route, we relay the packet along that route. Okay. So if we want to get something like our least hop count, then we just assign a cost of 1 for each link, and then the minimum cost is the shortest route. We could also assign at least a nominal financial cost to a link, and that would give us the cheapest route, and that cost could either be a genuine cost or just a fictitious cost. We can assign, we can base the cost on packet delays. So if a link is, or a node is overloaded, then you give a higher cost to its outgoing links to minimize the usage of those links and allow the node to clear its backlog. And possibly, packet transmission time could be used, and here you would end up finding the maximum bandwidth route, so the transmission time for your through the system would be minimized. Okay, so there's, you know, sort of any number of factors you can choose, or possibly some combination. Okay. Once you have this idea of link costs and the idea that you want to find the minimal cost path, the question then becomes, well, how do you actually find the path? Okay. And again, you need some sort of algorithm to do this, and so there's got to be some decision-making procedure which tells you when you're at any given node, where should that node send the packet next. Okay. Algorithms can be divided into two classes, non-adaptive, and here a decision is made sort of at a certain point in time, and then typically you do that by observations of the network, and you can pre-determine the paths based on the data that you've obtained. Okay, and so if you assume that the conditions of the network are not going to change very often, then that's fine. Unfortunately, the network conditions tend to be very fluid. So our second option is to have an adaptive algorithm. And here, the routing decisions change as the network conditions change, either as the physical topology of the network changes or the traffic flowing through the network changes. Okay. As an extreme case, this could lead to you, for any individual packet, having an entirely new route. So even if a user is generating streams of packets, then each one might be, take a different route through the network. And, again, that can cause problems at the far end, just in terms of reassembling streams of information. So, in addition to thinking about adaptive and non-adaptive, we can think about, the next question is what information do we need to make the decision on when the topology is changing? And again, we have two possibilities here. We can get the information from neighboring routers, or we can get the information from all of the routers. Okay, so the plus of getting the information from neighboring routers is that you have a relatively small amount of information being exchanged. The minus of that sort of system is that it then takes a while for any changes to propagate through the entire network. So you would be relying on sort of, again, single, the information would travel only, over a single link at a time. On the other hand, if you get information from everybody, it's quicker, but you have to then limit the amount, the type of information that you send in order to not overwhelm the network with just information exchange. Okay, and there's also, we need to decide when we will decide what changes to make in the routing policy. So we can do that periodically, or we can wait till something happens, again, some combination thereof. Okay. So, in addition to this, there's a question of who should determine these algorithms, who should make the decision about the routes, and we could possibly have a centralized decision-making body, so you'd have one server somewhere, But yeah, centralized solutions don't scale. So for the size of the network, it would having a centralized processor determining the routes would quickly run into bottlenecks and performance issues, and of course the risk of having that single server keel over. So in practice, the routing algorithms are adaptive, okay, because of the relatively rapidly changing conditions within the network, and decentralized. So we don't have a single entity determining the routes, but rather all of the nodes together work together to determine the optimal routes. Okay, so now we'll have a look at how these decentralized algorithms work. And so we're going to look at two common policies, distance vector routing and link state routing. And so the difference between the two is going to be hinge on the information exchanged, and again, based on the type of information you're exchanging, is going to determine how exactly your algorithm works. Okay, so with distance vector routing, each router exchanges information about the entire network with neighboring routers, and it does this periodically, so at a regular interval. So a large amount of information is being exchanged, but only sort of over a finite space. Okay. So neighboring routers are ones that are connected by a direct link, and regular intervals tend to be something on the order of every 30 seconds. Okay. So, again, the drawback with this is that if something happens, then for each 30-second period, the information of what has happened was only going to travel over one link. So if your network is large and has lots of links, it's going to take you a long time to actually have a complete view of what's going on in the network. On the other hand, we'll see that the processing of the information that's exchanged is relatively straightforward. The second option is link state routing, and here each router exchanges information about its neighbors or its neighborhood, so the links that it's connected to, and it does this with all the routers in the network. When does it do it? It does it when there's a change. So in this way, each router is, you exchange a relatively small amount of information over a wide area, and you only do it in response to changes. Okay, so again, the neighborhood of the router is the set of neighbor routers. So what you can connect to directly, and you give information about everything to all of the nodes. Okay, and changes typically have to do with either severe congestion or link failure potentially, and can be detected if your neighbor is not responding to your messages. Again, because you flood the network, it's possible for your link state algorithm to converge faster. And we'll see that the algorithm for determining the response is a bit more complex than for, or the routes is a bit more complex than for distance vector. Okay. So in order to sort of get some idea of how these work, we're just going to run through a series of examples and see how the routing algorithm, the link state and the distance vector algorithms work for these examples. So here we have routers, and the blue boxes represent routers, and they're connected with direct links, okay, so over LAN or just a point-to-point connection. And so, again, neighbors are anything where the links are directly connected. Okay, so we'll start again with our first with distance vector routing. And so again, with distance vector routing, the neighbors talk to each other. So you only exchange information with whoever you're directly connected to. So A will send information to B, F, and E. He'll do that over networks 1478 and 23, respectively. Okay. F sends information to A over network 78. E sends information to A and D over 23 and 8, respectively. Okay. So, again, you only have direct sharing of information between routers on the same network. In order for information then to propagate further, well, what will happen is that when a router gets information from its neighbor, it will include that information in its view of the network. So if A sends information to B, B will include that information in its view of the network, of the entire network. And sort of in the next round of information exchange, B sends his updated view of the network to C. So over two rounds of information exchange, the information of A travels to C. Okay, but again, the bigger your network, the more rounds of information exchange are going to be required to get the information propagated. Now, the nodes are going to store the information in a routing table, so they use then the routing table to decide on what information or they use the routing tables to decide how to forward the packets, and the routing tables are the information that's exchanged then. Okay. So the routing table has to have a few pieces of information. It needs the network ID, which is the final destination. So that would be, the packet would come in with a destination, and that's, you would use that destination to determine where to send your packet out, and that would obviously be the next hop. And we will also want to track the cost of traveling to the destination via that next hop. Okay. So when we start out, all the router is going to know is the networks that's directly connected to, and we're going to assume here that we're looking for a least hop solution, so the cost for each link is going to be one. Okay. The cost is associated with putting the data onto the network, and we just then assume that there's no cost to, once it's on, there's no additional cost to retrieving the data. So, as an example, router A is directly connected to networks 14, 78, and 23. So, if any of those are our final destination, then it would be a cost of one for A, for a packet arriving at A, to go be put onto any of those networks. Okay. To start out with, that would be all of the information that the routers would have, is just what they're directly connected to. So, in order to get more information, the routers are again going to have to exchange information with each other. Okay. So, the routers exchange tables. And here, in our example, A receives information from B. A receives the table from B. Okay. So now A has new possibilities. It can put data directly on the networks as before, or it can send the data to B. And so this will, by forwarding it to B, then the data can be further forwarded to anything that B can reach. So it increases the number of networks that A can reach. The cost, of course, is you're adding a hop. So if you have to send it to B to reach the network, then that takes one hop. And then B has an idea of what destinations it can reach. Okay, so at the moment B is connected directly to networks 14 and 55. It would cost one hop for B to send onto those links. So for A to send onto those networks would cost, the cost once you're at B plus one hop to reach B. Okay, so from A, it would cost 2 to reach network 14, or 2 to reach network 55. So A will merge the two tables, and possibly this will give several possibilities for reaching networks, so both A and B can reach network 14, and obviously you want to keep the lower cost option, so you would not route a packet to reach network 14. Okay, and so this merging creates a new table for A, where it can reach more networks, possibly by now having to forward the link to another router. Okay. So the algorithm for updating the tables is referred to as the distributed Bellman-Ford algorithm. And the idea is, again, you add one to the cost of each received route. If you have a new destination, you add that information to the routing table. If you get new information on an existing destination, then if the next hop field is the same, replace the existing entry with the new information, even if you have a greater cost, because this means that, you know, again, your neighbor has some information about what is going on in the network, and you want to keep the newest information, okay. If the next hop field is not the same, only replace the existing entry with new information if the cost is lower, okay. And so, again, you're then choosing between two different possibilities, not just sort of updating information. Okay, so we can look at, again, the merging. So we have a routing table, and we get some information from one of the nodes. So the information from the node has to be updated in the sense that you have to increment the cost by one, and then you'll want to merge the values in the into a single table. So network one, you have no new information, so that remains the same. Network 2, the information is coming from C, and it's saying that the cost of the path is now greater, so you update the cost of the path. Network 6, the destination, or the next hop is different, so it's giving the information that you can improve on your cost by changing from going to F to going to C. So you replace that. Network 8, there's no improvement, so you don't change that. And network 9, again, you will not improve by changing to C, so you don't update network 9. Okay. So, in that way, you have a relatively straightforward, simple way of merging information and finding the best route for your packet to take. And by best route, each node is just determining where to forward the information on, so a single forwarding link. Okay, so if you care to work it out, this would be the where you would you'd arrive at something like a this sort of a table or this sort of information for each of the nodes using the algorithm. Again, exactly what you arrive at will depend on the exact sequence of updates. So you might get some small variations along of paths. This was the original ARPANET routing protocol. And again, when you think ARPANET was not an overly large network, and even at the start of the internet, it was used in the form of the Routing Information Protocol. Again, the problem is that it's... The drawback of this routing is that with size, the propagation of information just ends up taking too long. Having said that, it is a variant of this is still used in what's called a border gateway protocol. And the idea here is that we actually have sort of a hierarchical view of the internet, where you have sort of regions that sort of interact and cooperate with amongst themselves. But if they want to move into different regions, or we refer to regions as autonomous systems, then they have to move via a gateway. Okay, so you have relatively fewer gateways connecting all of these autonomous systems together, and the border gateway protocol then uses a variation of distance vector routing so to determine routes from one autonomous system to the next and to the next. Okay. And yeah, as I said before, the link cost doesn't have to be one. It could be other factors that you want to account for. But in practice, again, with it, if you have a sort of a large flat system, the distance vector routing does run into problems. Okay, we've said that we've described it before. The name of the problem is the count to infinity problem, and again, the problem is that the idea is that information only propagates one link per round of information exchange, and so this causes quite slow reaction to changes within the network. Okay, so it's possible, you know, that people tried to sort of patch this algorithm, but in the end, it was decided that it was sort of difficult and to deal with the problem. And so, again, a new solution was explored. So our distance vector routing exchanged a lot of information, but only between neighbors. Our other possibility is link state routing. And the idea here is that nodes share this information, share information with everybody. Now, again, in terms of scaling, that you really can't send a lot of information because you'd be clogging up the network just sending information. So they send a smaller amount of information. The nodes send information about their neighborhood or their neighbors. So they exchange, the information exchanged is the cost to reach different neighbors. Okay. This information is exchanged whenever there is a change in the network. And what it means is that each of the nodes within the network in short order quickly gets a view of the entire network. Okay. So the nodes have this view of the network, a complete view of the network, and the question then becomes, what should the nodes do with that view? Okay. So, again, we'll build up our understanding looking at examples, and here we're going to look at different costs to the various links in the network. Again, the cost is related to putting information onto the links, so from a router to a network, and possibly the costs can vary even in different directions. Okay, so the example we use, we've just sort of, for the purposes of example, assigned some costs to our links, so costs for the routers to put information on the network. Okay, and so the information that's needed for the routers to get the full picture of the network is the advertiser, so what router is advertising, what networks they can reach, the cost of reaching those networks, and where they can get to by reaching those networks. Okay, and so A, again, can reach 3 different networks, 14, 78, and 23. It has a cost associated, again, with putting data onto those networks, and putting data onto those networks allows it to reach a new set of routers. Okay. And so A can then, will flood the network with that information. So all of the routers should receive information about how A perceives the network, what A's neighborhood looks like. Okay. So, based on that, it can again build up a complete complete view of the network. So, so essentially it gets all of the information about what each individual router it can reach. Okay. So the table encompasses, contains a total view of the network. So what's not there yet, certainly, is any sort of decision about how to forward packets. Okay, so if you look at the neighbors, well, then you're going to essentially see what is reachable, but there are a lot of options for reaching any given point. So A can reach C either by going to B or to D. And at the moment, we wouldn't have any good way of assessing which one would be better. So we need to have some sort of algorithm for figuring out our paths. And so for any router, and we're going to use A in our example, A is going to have a picture of what the network looks like, and so a picture like this. And A is going to want to decide what's the least cost option for reaching any other node. Okay. So it starts again by building up this picture. Again, it costs to put data onto the network, and it's free to pull the data back off the network. The Dijkstra's shortest path algorithm will create what's called a shortest path spanning tree for the router. And so shortest path refers to, again, finding the shortest costs. And the idea of a tree is that there are no loops in the tree, so you won't get lost sort of forwarding packets back and forth to routers along the path. Okay. The way the algorithm works is that we start with the root of the tree being the router, or the node running the algorithm, and that node is trying to reach all of the other nodes. And so it'll separate the other nodes into what are called temporary and permanent nodes. A node is permanent if the shortest path to that node has been determined, and it's temporary if the node is still working on that. So when the algorithm starts running, well, everybody is in the temporary set. Okay. And the router itself is permanent. Okay, I should also say within the temporary set, it's nodes that the Rotor has determined a path to already. So to start out, the temporary set contains the neighbors of the router itself. So the algorithm's going to go along and try to move nodes from the temporary to the permanent category by considering the cost and sort of move in the lowest cost first. And it'll stop when it's moved all of the nodes from temporary into permanent. Okay. So, what the algorithm does is it identifies the temporary node whose arc has the lowest cumulative cost from the root, and we move this node and arc into the permanent set. And we update our temporary set now. So we look at our new permanent node and if there are any nodes that can be reached from the new permanent node which are not in the temporary set, we put that node into the temporary set. Also, if there's a node in the temporary set that's reachable by our new permanent node and is reachable with a lower cumulative cost from the node, then we replace the old root with our new root. And we do this until all of our nodes are made permanent. So the best way to sort of come to grips with this, I think, is to just run through an example and see how it's working. So we start with our node A. So node A can reach the network, the three networks, and so that's our initial view of the network. And so we then ask, well, what nodes can we reach via those three networks, and what's the least cost to reach one? And that would be by going to B via 14. Okay. And so it costs 1 to go to B. So we add 14 into our permanent set of permanent nodes, and then we add B into our set of permanent nodes, and we see that from B we can reach network 55 with, again, now a cumulative cost of 3. Okay, so if we go back to our example, B can reach 55 with a cost of 2, and A can reach B with a cost of 1, so you have to take the cumulative cost over the network then of 3. Okay, so again, the question becomes then, what's the next thing we can reach, or what's the next cheapest, least cost node that we can reach, and node either being a network or a router, and we see we can reach network 23, and then from Network 23, we can reach E with a cost of 2. Once we've made E permanent, we see that we can reach Network 8 via E with a cumulative cost of 4, so we add that into our temporary. So the next question is, what's the next least cost node we can reach? Well, we can reach either 78 or 55 with a cost of 3, so we arbitrarily choose one of those to reach. Here we chose 78. From 78, you can reach F, again, with the same cost. Again, arbitrarily choose something to reach, so we'll choose F to make permanent, and then add to the temporary set of nodes anything that can be reached by F. Okay. So we keep going with that, marking our cumulative costs and choosing the next least cost. So after F, we can reach 55 by 3. That would be the lowest cost. Add that. From that, we can reach C with the same cost. Add C. From C, we can reach 66, again with a cost of 5. Looking for the next least cumulative cost, it would be reaching Network 8 from E, and then D from D from Network 8. Now, at this point, we know that D reaches Network 66 as well, and if it did it for a lower cumulative cost, then we would replace that link. But it doesn't. It's C. If you could reach D for a lower if you could reach 66 for a lower cumulative cost, you would change the link to root to Network 66 from C to D, but in this case it doesn't. So you would leave it as is, looking around for the next least cumulative cost. You would add Network 66 again, and finally Network 92. So when the algorithm finishes, we have again a collection of paths which with representing sort of the least cost to reach any point in the network and not having loops. Okay. Now Dijkstra's algorithm is relatively straightforward to prove. You would prove it using sort of a recursive proof. So you would start at the beginning and argue that if you have a least cost path, then anywhere from there has to be least cost. Okay. But the bottom line for us is that once the router has found the spanning tree, it can use that to build its routing table. And so to reach any network, it can determine a cost and the next hop which you would have to take. So as an example, to take the first to reach network 8, it would cost us 4, and we'd go through network E, and that seems straightforward enough. To reach 66, we'll go through network 14 to router B as a next hop. Okay, so I was talking about 66. So our next hop is B, and the overall cost is 5. Okay, so this method does require more work at the nodes, although I think in sort of this day and age, it's nothing that can't be handled. When the algorithms were initially proposed, it was more of an issue. In practice, since there's no sort of synchronization of the information being received or acted on, the routers will have slightly different views of the network at any time. And so that may sort of lead to sort of a less than perfect view of the, that might lead to a less than perfect algorithm within the network as a whole. Okay, so in practice, it works better than distance vector routing. It converges quicker. You generate less traffic overall, and you have a rapid response to topology changes. Internet routing protocols are based now on these link state algorithms, and you have open shortest path first algorithm in sort of for, again, peer networks, or intermediate system to intermediate system routing if you want to, again, develop something of a hierarchy. And again, with these algorithms, you can configure your link costs based on the sorts of quantities that we've been discussing, and use this to try and, again, optimize the quality of service within the network. So, okay, so again, they are computationally more expensive than the distance vector routing policies. And there are some practicalities to take care of, and in particular, we're using flooding to transmit our propagate our information. And so you have to sort of limit the lifetime of the messages in the network, and so so that they don't just keep bouncing around the network forever. And so link state information packets will insert time to live fields in the packets and time to live fields decrement as you for each hop that the for each time the packet is forwarded, and therefore and when the and then when the time to live is finished, the packet is just dropped from the network. So you have to, again, control the information and the lifetime of the information. Okay, so that's the basic ideas behind routing and the ideas behind the routing protocols used. And so they're distributed and decentralized in order to make them scalable and fault tolerant. And we've seen that we have our two main varieties, distance vector routing and link state routing, which differ in how they propagate the information through the network and how much information they propagate, which then in turn has an impact on sort of the actual algorithm that's used to build up the routing tables. And as we said, in practice, link states performs better sort of over in larger networks. So we'll leave that for the moment. The next topic will be looking at sort of specific aspects of the internet. So we'll say a little bit more about IP, and particularly how IP is used in addressing, and then have a look at the transport layer protocols of TCP and UDP and what are some of the main mechanisms in TCP to try and, again, improve the quality of service over the internet. So that'll be the next lecture.